Jeff Brock, Ken Bromberg, and Yair Minsky. So what's the general goal? Is to understand the deformation space of all hyperbolic tree manifolds of a fixed homotopy type. So understand, and we're going to talk about really the topology of this space. This is the space of all hyperbolic tree manifolds, homotopy equivalent to a fixed compact manifold M. So what's the basic status of things? By the 1970s, the topology of the interior of this space was very well understood due to the work largely of Lippmann Behrs, but of a number of other people. In the 90s, we began to understand that the topology of the entire space was really quite bad. So there's a number of results saying how bad it is, perhaps culminating with Ken Bromberg's proof that in some cases the space isn't even locally connected, which sort of makes you wonder if there's any hope for anything. On the other hand, one should think about perhaps the analogy with Teichmuller space, where the interior is quite well behaved, and the boundary, there's some, you know, sort of unpleasant things that happen on the boundary, but on the other hand, at most places in the boundary, things behave rather well. And so what I'm going to talk about today are some results of this type, which say that, you know, at the average point in the boundary, things are pretty well behaved. And one remark I should make, since we've had a number of lectures about the ending lamination conjecture, you might think to yourself, the ending lamination conjecture provides a complete classification of the points in AH of M. Therefore, we should understand exactly what AH of M looks like. But the basic problem here, and the reason that the topology is so complicated, is that all that data, all the invariants in the ending lamination conjecture vary discontinuously over this space in its natural topology, and I'll tell you what that topology is. So while the ending lamination conjecture is a tool for understanding the topology, it doesn't completely tell us the topology. It doesn't provide a parameterization of the space. And so we're not only going to use the ending lamination conjecture as a tool, but we're going to, in fact, use some of the techniques of proof of the ending lamination conjecture in trying to understand this deformation space. So we'll see where that comes up later. So perhaps it will justify some of the extra structure of the model manifold that is developed in the course of the, at least Jeff Brock, Yair and I's proof of the ending lamination conjecture. Okay. So let's assume M is it's compact, it's hyperbolizable, which means its interior admits a hyperbolic structure, and it's an oriented three-manifold. And for simplicity, let's assume this isn't really going to play a role in anything we say, but it's going to make it easier to say things, that boundary of M contains no tori. And this would not be a very interesting story if we don't also assume the boundary is non-empty, because not Mostow rigidity tells you that AH is just exactly 2 points if the manifold is closed. So what is our space? AH of M. To give it topology, we're going to, instead of thinking of it as a space of marked hyperbolic three manifolds, we're going to think of it as a space of discrete faithful representations, and it's going to inherit, and this space is then going to inherit a topology from the representation variety. So this is representations from Pi1M into PFL2C. These are discrete and faithful. And then we mod out by conjugation. Okay. That sits inside an algebraic variety known as the character variety, which is the quotient of the full representation variety. By PFL2C. Okay. So why does this give us the same thing? Well, if we have a representation in AH of M, that gives rise to a hyperbolic 3 manifold, which is the quotient of the representation, quotient of H3 by the image of the representation, and moreover, there exists H row, a map from M to N row. This is a homotopy equivalence such that H sub rho star gives you the same identification as rho does. Okay, so this homotopy equivalence is the marking, and I'm going to sort of suppress this, but you should really think of these as not just the space of hyperbolic 3 manifolds, but the space of marked hyperbolic 3 manifolds. Okay, so I'll set up some notation. So if you have a group of isometries of hyperbolic 3 space, it acts not just on hyperbolic 3 space, but on the boundary of hyperbolic 3 space is a group of conformal automorphisms. So this is, and then you can look at the largest open set in the Riemann sphere, where this group of homeomorphisms, where this group of conformal automorphisms acts discontinuously. And since you have a group of conformal automorphisms acting on a domain, you naturally get a Riemann surface as a quotient. This is usually, well, sometimes at least, called the conformal boundary. And then you can form a manifold with boundary n sub rho hat just by throwing that on. Okay, and so what would the nicest possible situation would be? The nicest possible situation would be that, in fact, this gives a compactification of your manifold. So rho is called convex co-compact. If this is compact, and it's a result of Marden and Sullivan, it says that in fact lying in the interior of AH of M is equivalent to being convex co-compact. So these nicest possible manifolds are the interior of your deformation space. Okay. So, moreover, there's a complete parameterization of the interior. And so the components, and this is sort of similar to the parameterization of the Mandelbrot set, the interior is, the components are enumerated by topological data, and each component interior is parameterized by analytic data. So what is the topological interior here? The topological, what is the set of topological data? Well, it's A of M, which is the set of marked 3 manifolds, homotopy equivalent to M, up to orientation-preserving homeomorphism. So this is, right, sort of the topological Teichmuller space of M. Okay? And then there's, so this general result goes back to the main tool is the measurable Riemann mapping theorem of all fours and bears. There's also work here of Maskett and Craw. And the way I'm going to state it, it also makes use of Thurston's geometrization theorem. So we'll throw that in. It says that the interior of AH of M is just identified with, well, there's a set of components. There's one component for every marked homeomorphism type, and that component has the form that it's the Teichmuller space of all conformal structures on the boundary of the 3 manifold, and then you mod out by some group. Mod not M prime. I don't want to get too far into it, but mod not M prime is the group of homeomorphisms of M prime, which are, it's a group of isotopy classes of homeomorphisms M prime, which are homotopic to the identity. So it's just generated by Dane twists about compressible curves. Okay, and this is a very natural map. There's nothing super mysterious about it. If you have a manifold row, if you have a representation row, you identify it to, well, there's a homeomorphic, how do you get a compact 3-manifold homeomorphic to M? Well, it's just the conformal compactification. So it's the equivalence class of n hat row. And how do you get a point in the Teichmuller space of the boundary? Well, you just take the Riemann surface, which is the conformal boundary. You can think of it as lying in the Teichmuller space of the boundary of M prime. So it's a fair amount of work to show that this is gives rise to a homeomorphism, but just defining it is not that complicated to see. Okay, so let me make a few remarks here. So if M has compressible boundary, has incompressible boundary, so one way of thinking about this is just to think that the fundamental group of M does not split any interesting ways of free product. Another way to think of it is to think of it as you have a curve which is homotopically trivial in the 3-manifold, a curve on the boundary which is homotopically trivial in the 3-manifold. It's also homotopically trivial on the surface. Okay? Then in this case, mod naught M prime is trivial. So the interior of AH of M is just a union of balls. And moreover, our assumption that the boundary contains no tori is going to in fact tell us that in fact it's a finite union of balls. So if boundary then has no tori, it's a finite union of balls. So that's rather nice topological situation. And on the other hand, just for general culture, if M has compressible boundary, then typically there are infinitely many components and each of them has infinitely generated fundamental group. No, this is typically the case. Moreover, I guess, it's actually not going to play a role. I'm just trying to give a little survey of what's known about the topology of the deformation space before I talk about anything new. So you can, in fact, say exactly when it has finally many components and exactly when it happens to have finally generated fundamental group, but they're sort of you can write down the cases pretty simply. Okay, and then finally, so this was all known by, the last piece of this is Thurston's geometrization theorem, and you skip ahead 20 years. We now know that, in fact, AH of M is the closure of its interior. Okay, and there's a very long story here, but it's roughly the original, or at least one of the proofs is tameness, which is due to Eagle and Caligari Gabay, plus the ending lamination conjecture, plus convergence results. And these convergence results go back to Thurston, and then also using results of Klein-Dumsoto, Ashika, Laquier, Kim Laquier, Ashika. And then there's a final trick, final details, which are worked out either by both by Ashika and Nomatsi-Soto. So it's sort of a long story. There's an alternative approach. Now the cone manifold deformation theory. And so in fact this approach was worked out in many cases before the ELC, so before ELC attainment, so before the other stuff, by Bromberg and Brock Bromberg, and then finally in all cases was worked out by Bromberg and Soto. Okay. So what I want to start getting into now is some of the topology, some of the sort of pathology, because you might think to yourself, well, at least in the incompressible boundary setting, my interior is a finite union of balls. And all the manifolds in this one have one homeomorphism type, and all the manifolds in this one have another homeomorphism type, and this one a third, and this one a fourth, etc. You might think to yourself, well, and especially if you know that it's the whole space is the closure interior, you might hope to yourself that it was just, the entire space was just four closed balls. And then you might even spend a couple years of your life trying to prove that these two balls didn't bump into each other. Because after all, if they bumped, what would that mean? There'd be some point there, and what should its homeomorphism type be? Well, it has to have this homeomorphism type, and it has to have that homeomorphism type, so it obviously can't exist. And you might, you know, work on it and be ready to announce it, your result, and then then you might construct a counterexample. We'll see that actually a lot of the work that went into trying to prove this thing, which is that not actually true, turns out to be useful in understanding when it's true and when it isn't. So it wasn't a dead loss. So we're going to call this behavior bumping. We're going to say two components. B and C of the interior bump at a point rho if rho is contained in the intersection of the closures. Oops. So that's our bumping point right there. And so starting in the sort of right around the mid-90s, Jim Anderson and I showed that, well, components can bump. And then we got a real topologist on board, Daryl McCullough. And show that you can, in fact, completely characterize which components bump, at least in the incompressible boundaries. Completely characterize when two components bump. If M has compressible boundary. Sorry, has incompressible boundary. And this characterization is entirely topological. Is in terms of the marked homeomorphism types associated with components. And basically, the theorem is the proof of this is of the form. There's a construction here, and we sort of roughly show if you can't do that construction, then you can't make components bump, and if you can do that construction, they can bump. Okay. And then there's a finer analysis in the same setting, due to John Holt, where he characterizes not only which pairs of components bump, he characterizes which collections of components bump. And again, this is in the case when M has incompressible boundary. And another thing we should note here is this characterization, this analysis gives you, together with the density conjecture, a complete enumeration of the components. So that's maybe one of the first things you might ask about a space is how many components they have and can you enumerate them. And so this gives you an answer for that in terms of topological data. But then there's deformation spaces, in fact, where there's only one component, say quasi-Fuchsian space or Schottky space or bare slices, which we won't go into, but are sitting around back here. And it turned out that the same construction gives rise to self-bumping of the components. So you might have a component come around and do something like that. So we say a component B of the interior self-bumps at rho if there exists a neighborhood W of rho such that if V is any sub-neighborhood, then V minus rho is disconnected. What? Yeah, V is any, so V, P, sub, by sub-neighborhood I mean that, yeah. Right. Yeah. Oh, so so this is correct if you take AH of M as a space and you take it and you give it its induced topology. These are open neighborhoods in the induced topology in AHM. Equivalently, you could take a neighborhood W of rho in the full character variety, and then you would have to take V minus rho intersection AH, and that would be disconnected. Those are, anyway, I think they're topologically equivalent statements. So. Oh, right, yeah. So, in fact, here this is, I quotient it out by PSL2C, so I'm always, yeah, so when I write rho, I should always really write the equivalence class of rho here, but I'm not going to be that careful. Okay. So then there's a history here, too. So McMullen showed that QF of that, the quasi-Fuchsian space on any closed surface, which is the interior of the of a trivial I-bundle, interior of the deformation space AH of a trivial I-bundle, self-bumps. And then Bromberg and Holt showed that if M contains a primitive essential annulus, then every component self-bumps. Turn to regret not making slides. So, what is a primitive essential annulus? So, an essential annulus is, you know, just an embedding of an annulus into your manifold. So, the boundary of the annulus goes to the boundary of the three manifold. It's essential. If you can't push that annulus up into the boundary while keeping the boundary in the boundary, and the primitive just means that if you look at the injection of the fundamental group of the annulus into the fundamental group of the manifold, it should give rise to a maximal cyclic subgroup. And it turns out that in this, like I said, these all go back to the same construction, and in that construction, it is important that you use a primitive essential annulus. The point being that if you have a curve on the boundary of your three-manifold, which has a root within the three-manifold group, you can't make it parabolic. You can't pinch it and make it parabolic. And that's what it all comes down to. This sort of seemingly rather odd restriction comes from a very basic point about the geometry of hyperbolic three-manifolds. Okay, and then, oops. We're almost done with history. I'll do something new. It always takes longer than I think. So, then finally, Bromberg says that the space of punctured torus groups is not even locally connected. So if you want to think about this, this is a relative. It's actually a little outside of the setting where we define things, but one expects from his proof that in fact always AH of S cross I is going to be not locally connected. In fact, you expect many deformation spaces are not locally connected. So, okay. So this is all the bad stuff that's happened. So now let's sort of talk about when do good things happen? And so we call a point rho in the boundary of AH of M. We say this is untouchable. If there's no bumping or self-bumping at the point. Okay. So none of this bad stuff happens there. In particular, this implies that AH of M is locally connected at rho. Okay? So, if you want to follow sort of the very, very loose analogy between... Isn't it? Yeah, if you're not locally connected, does that imply, I forget the definition, it doesn't play any small enough neighborhood disconnects? So there'd be self-bumping? I think that's just the definition of locally connected, right? What?
Depends on the definition of bumping and self-bumping.
The definition of self-bumping
is that there's a neighborhood such that any sub-neighborhood at the point disconnects. Yeah, no, it's not just that picture. If you look at the actual definition I wrote down, yeah, no. You know, if you ask me about point set topology, it's a sure way to confuse me. You know, if the rest of the talk makes no sense, he brought up point set topology. It's just threw me off my game. What? V what? Oh, you're right. Yeah. Yeah. Right, because otherwise bumping would imply self-bumping. Okay. Tosh definitely going down the toilet now. Okay. Any other comments? Okay. Yeah. Okay. So if you follow the very loose analogy between AH of M and sort of Teich Muller space of a surface, one thing you sort of know is that the best places in the boundary of the Teich Muller space are where nothing gets cusped. It's the cusps you sort of really have to worry about. And so similarly, in this setting, if you don't have any parabolics at a point in your boundary, it's going to be pretty good there. So that's the first theorem. So if rho contain the boundary of AH of M. And you could say this a lot of different ways, but suppose rho of pi 1 of M contains no parabolic elements. Then rho is untouchable. Okay, so instead of saying contains no parabolics, you say the quotient manifold has no cusps. Anyway. So what's the idea here? Well, the main part of the idea is that if you take a sequence of representations approaching rho, they always approach rho not only algebraically, but geometrically. So the convergence here is a very strong notion of convergence. So I'll write this down. So if rho I contains an AH of M, and rho I converges to rho, then if you look at the quotient manifold, they converge in the sense of Gromov. What that means is that larger and larger chunks of n sub rho look more and more geometrically like larger and larger chunks of the approximants. And it's the failure of this fact in the presence of parabolics which gives rise to all the trouble in the world. There are other things giving rise to trouble in the world. Actually, right at the moment, but in our world, and in this talk, the parabolics give rise to all the trouble in the world. And this is so the strong convergence goes back to Thurston, and again, Jim Anderson and I. And then that implies, if larger and larger chunks look like larger and larger chunks, well, then the manifolds should really be homeomorphic to one another. So using either work of Yair and I or Oshika, this says that n rho I is homeomorphic to n rho for all large I. So right away, no bumping. If there's bumping, there should be points arbitrarily close to you with a different homeomorphism type. And then, let me be very loose here. One can also check that end invariance of rho I converge to end invariance of rho in a strong enough sense. The proof doesn't actually contain a statement like this, but that's the moral of the proof, so which you can use. To rule out self-bumping. Right, so I mean, it's some very vague moral level that you can say the space of end invariance is nice at that point. So if you pull it back by a map which is continuous at a point, then you also get nice neighborhoods. Anyway, I can't prove it that way, but it's sort of the moral of the story. Okay. Well, okay, but now. We also then want to sort of understand at which parabolic points do we expect trouble. So we define a sort of class of parabolics at which things are well behaved. We say rho is quasi-conformally rigid. Let me just say QC rigid if its conformal boundary consists of thrice punctured spheres. You know, and it could be the empty set of thrice functioned spheres. So the basic thing you have in mind is you have, say, some manifold with one boundary component, and you've taken a maximal collection of curves on the boundary, and you've pinched them. So these are often known as maximal cusps. So maximal cusps are sort of probably the most basic example of quasi-conformally rigid. And the two extremes here are when you have a maximal cusp and when you have the limit set being the entire sphere, so you have no conformal boundary at all. And those are sort of the two cases which are usually easiest to handle here. Okay. So let's first talk about bumping, because the bumping, we can do a very complete analysis in this setting. We can show that, in fact, there's no bumping at these quasi-conformally rigid points. To avoid self-bumping, we're at least for the moment going to have to place a few more restrictions on the situation. So if rho is in the boundary, this is QC rigid, then there's no bumping at M. Okay, which roughly means there's no change of homeomorphism type in a neighborhood of rho. Okay, and the proof, again, is simply a matter of putting together stuff we already knew. So there's a So here's where we're going to use a piece of the original alleged proof that there was no bumping at all to show that at least there's no bumping in this case. So without loss, so suppose rho I converges to rho, then we can pass to a subsequence. And here comes a dreaded geometric limit, right? I mean, I don't know what this conference went. When did geometric limits become such a dirty word? Anyway, pass to a subsequence. I like bumping. Does that explain why I've always liked geometric limits? So that n sub rho I converges to some manifold, say n infinity, geometrically. Okay. And moreover, you know that there exists, you don't know that they're equal, but there's always a covering map here. The algebraic limit covers the geometric limit. Okay. But of course, in general, the geometric limit can be rather disgusting. It can have infinitely generated fundamental group. Even if n rho might be so nice as to be geometrically finite, then n infinity could be so awful as to be infinitely generated. But we do know, so here's where the piece of the original alleged proof, or one of the places it comes in, we do know that there exists a compact core. C rho for n rho which embeds in the geometric limit n infinity. Okay, I should draw a picture here. So here you are in n rho, and you've found some sort of compact core here, and then you know you projected it down into this horrible, hideous beast. This is in N. Here's an infinity. There's your covering map C. And on the other hand, there's now N sub rho I, Yeah, I mean, they're out here somewhere. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, do you have idea, better idea how to draw the picture? Anyway, so in fact, I didn't draw a picture in my notes. And so the point is that this compact core then, since n sub rho I looks more like n sub rho, you can pull the compact core back. This is pi of c, and then you get sort of, you pull it back to c sub I. This looks a lot like this, and you get a compact core here. So what does that tell you? That the compact core for n sub rho I is homeomorphic to the compact core for c for all large I. You can pull back pi of c rho into the approximate. Well, this is for large I to get a compact core. For n sub rho I. But now the compact core for n sub rho I is homeomorphic to the compact core for n sub rho. And you think if two manifolds have the same compact core, they really ought to be homeomorphic. So if you then you have to apply a topological result of McCullough, Miller, and Swaroop, which tells you that the homeomorphism type of the compact core is uniquely determined by the manifold, and tameness. And this implies that n sub rho I is homeomorphic to n sub rho for all large I. So, in fact, if you notice, I could have skipped the use of my work with Yair or Ashika in that previous argument the same way. Oops, I got one more board over there, don't I? What? Oh, here? Yeah. This uses the QC rigid. Yeah, I didn't. There's, in fact, a more general statement. But so I'm using the statement that if n sub rho is quasi-conformally rigid, then there's a compact core for n sub rho which embeds in any geometric limit of an approximating sequence. The statement is, if it helps you, it says that if n sub rho is a generalized web group, that's the formal statement, a generalized web group is, it roughly means that there's no accidental parabolics. So there's no annuli joining essential annuli joining a cusp to a conformal boundary component. As long as you have that, then you can guarantee this. So. Okay. So once you have this, just to finish it off, so the homeomorphism type is locally constant. At rho, which implies no bumping at rho. Okay. And that was completely, like I said, this is completely general. We used absolutely nothing about M. So now, when I want to rule out self-bumping, at least for the moment, we're going to have to place a few more restrictions on the situation. So, it's our definition. Let me restrict it. I'm going to be fairly careful about what I state here. I think we can do a little more than this, but let me not say it. So, rho is a maximal cusp if you look at n sub rho hat, and this is homeomorphic to some compact manifold. Minus a maximal a pants decomposition, maximal compact manifold R minus a pants decomposition of the boundary of R. So that was the picture we have here. We have a manifold with boundary, and we've taken a set of curves and we've pinched them. Okay? And then the theorem if M is either acylindrical or is a surface cross I, then and rho contained in the boundary of AHM is a maximal cusp, then rho is untouchable. Okay? And so what should be true by the basic techniques we're doing, but we haven't run it all down now, is that if rho is quasi-conformally rigid and M has incompressible boundary, then the techniques we're using should really go through. But we're still fussing about a few things. Okay. So let's just sort of let's give an outline of the proof. And let's pick a relatively simple case. So let's assume M is acylindrical and there's only one boundary component. So we have just this, exactly this picture. And let alpha 1, so let's say alpha 1 through alpha n, be the curves on boundary of M, which are cusped. Okay, so what is the first thing we're going to do to get control of self-bumping is we need to define some sort of neighborhood basis for the deformation space at rho. So at the maximal cusp, all three of those curves, or in my picture, have length 0. So if you had all three of those curves short, you should be nearby. And in fact, that's true. So if you define W epsilon to be the set of rho in AH of M, such that the length in rho of alpha I is less than epsilon, for all I, then this gives you a neighborhood basis. So you just need to check that if you pinch all of those curves to zero, that you end up at the maximal cusp. But that's true. So I guess Johansson's theorem is probably sitting behind that claim. So a little topology is sitting there. So a little fact here. W epsilon is a neighborhood basis at rho. So the claim is that for all epsilon bigger than 0, there exists some epsilon hat bigger than 0, such that if rho and rho prime are in W epsilon hat, they can be joined by a path entirely contained in W epsilon. And that's enough to imply no self-bumping at rho. Since given any small neighborhood, this allows you to always find a smaller neighborhood which doesn't disconnect. So what's the easy case? Well, the easy case would be, suppose you're sitting at row, and you look at row, and you have alpha 1, and you have alpha 2, and you have alpha 3, and in the conformal boundary structure, all those curves are short. Well, if they're all short in the conformal boundary, and you can take some other one where they're all short in the conformal boundary, you just move from one to the other using Fenchel-Nielsen coordinates, keeping everything short. Okay, so if length in the conformal boundary of alpha I and length in the conformal boundary of rho prime of alpha I are both less than, well, epsilon over 2, you can move from rho to rho prime by a line in the Fenchel-Nielsen coordinates, and you stay in W epsilon, because the point being that if you're on that line, the length of alpha I in the conformal boundary at any point in that line is less than epsilon over 2, and there's there's an inequality of Baer's, which tells you the length of the curve in the manifold is always then less than epsilon. So this is the easy case. What's the hard case? Well, you know that if you're in W epsilon, and epsilon is small, that the curves are short in the manifold. But it could be that you're out here, and at the conformal boundary, alpha I is long in conformal boundary, which means that it's short, but it's short. So here's maybe here are the Margulis tubes associated to alpha I. And they're way down in there. And if you just move along the Fenchel-Nielsen coordinates, you can't really predict what the length of these curves way down in the manifold, what's happening way down in the manifold as you deform the conformal structure sort of on the outside of the manifold. Okay, so that's a problem. And sort of one way this might arise is you might take a sequence of conformal structures and sort of first Dane twist really hard about the alpha I and then hit it with a very large pseudo-Nosov, many powers of a pseudo-Nosov, and build a big, large bounded geometry chunk buffer between the boundary of the convex core and the Margulis tubes. Okay, well, what are you going to do there? Well, this is where we actually have to not only use the proof of the ending lamination conjecture, which was used in the proof of no self-bumping in the non-parabolic case. Maybe I didn't say that, but you have to use. Now, you're not going to have to use, the statement of the ending lamination conjecture. You're going to have to actually use the techniques of proof, and you're going to have to actually use sort of the length bound developed by Minsky to show that you can do a deformation, and during that deformation, you can control those lengths. So, the word projection coefficients is about to come up. But maybe not if I run out of time before then. Okay. Maybe we'd all be happier. Okay. So, what's the basic idea? Is you don't want to join along a Fenchel-Nielsen line. Idea is if you Dane twist about alpha I in conformal boundary, and you got to do this in the right direction, so you've got to decide what the right direction is. Alpha I will get really short in outside the manifold. So what you can do is this has some sort of fixed, you know, alpha I has some length in the conformal boundary. You know it's short, but you might, so what you might want to do is you might want to say, I'm going to take that fairly long curve, and I'm going to pinch it down till it's short, and then I'm just going to use the Fenchel-Nielsen path. But if you pinch it down till it's short, while you're doing that, this curve might get long in the manifold. Because when you pinch it to get very short, you can do that by Lipschitz math with some uniform constant, but you don't know the relationship between that constant and the length of the short curve. So what you do is you first deign twist about the alpha I till you make this really, 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 really short. And once you've made all of these guys really, really, really short, then when you're doing some pinch, getting it from some uniformly bounded length down to length epsilon, that takes some bounded deformation. And in the process, these curves, which are really, really, really short, well, still stay really short. Okay. Uh-oh. This isn't good. Okay.
Why do you want performing dangerous this
curve doesn't kick
it off?
Well, here? So what I'm doing is I'm deign twisting along this really hard, and I'm going to make this curve even shorter. On the conformal boundary? First of all, you have to do it in the correct direction. If you do it in the wrong direction, it may get long. And so what you have to do, the point is, let me just say this out loud in words and not try to write anything down. The basic idea is the lengths of these curves are controlled by certain projection of the end invariance onto subsurfaces. And what you're going to do is you have to understand what the effect of deign twisting is on those projection coefficients. If once you pull back another level, you can't just deign twist about the first curve, then the second curve, and then the third curve. You have to do it in the right order. So you actually have to look at where these curves sit within the hierarchy picture. I've gone this far, so let me say a little more just out loud. So the point is, associated to each curve is some subsurface of S. And that subsurface of S is responsible for the curve being short. And what I mean by that is that if you take the projection of the end invariant associated to this end, and then the conformal structure associated to the totally geodesic boundary, those two things are very far apart when you project those end invariants down onto that subsurface. Okay, so really associated to each of these curves is some subsurface. Here's one here. And there's one there, and this guy is there. So even though those curves don't overlap, that these subsurfaces do overlap with one another. And so, what?
May
overlap with one another. And so the point is that it's okay. You look at the first subsurface you see, one that's on top of all other subsurfaces that it overlaps with, and if you deign twist about that curve first, you can make the twist coefficient very, very large. And once you've made the twist coefficient very large, it's unaffected by deign twisting about any of the other curves. And then you can move on. Once you've made the twist coefficient here very large, you can move on to the next one down, and you can deign twist about it. But what you've got to do at each stage in the argument is you've got to decide which to deign twist about, which curves to deign twist about, which direction to deign twist about it, and you've got to measure the effect on the relevant projection coefficients at each stage. So you're really getting down sort of into the guts of the hierarchy machinery. So this is hopefully some justification for all that work that Yair and Howie did to build that quite intricate. But people don't seem to keep using the word beautiful machinery. But it's a very powerful machinery, and you get control. I mean, what they did gives you control on sort of everything in sight. And so it allows you to really get your hands on it and know what effect a certain deformation has on the geometry, internal geometry of the manifold, in a very concrete way. And that's what makes this whole proof go. And to do the general incompressible boundary setting, you're going to have to combine this hierarchy machinery with Thurston's relative compactness theorems and sort of no window breaks theorem. So that's what's supposed to finish it off. Only windows break. Okay. You're right, yeah. No windows break, yeah. I better stop.
Are there any questions for our distinguished bumponomics?
Is there a Nobel Prize in bumponomics yet? Yeah, Jeremy? So what you're going to do is, what's sitting in here is there's a conformal structure on the inside of this surface, and that's roughly fixed by Thurston's bounded image theorem. Suppose we were in the quasi-Fuchsian case. You had a conformal structure here, you had a conformal structure here. You would take the shortest collection of curves on this surface, you would take the shortest collection, path decomposition on this surface, and then you would take the subsurface and you would project those, you would look at the intersection of those curves with the subsurface, and you get a bunch of arcs. And you could close those, if you want, you could work in the arc complex, or you could close those arcs off to curves and work in the curve complex and measure the distance between those two things. So that's if the subsurface isn't an annulus. If it's an annulus, it's a slightly different definition. Nayer was frowning at me. So, I mean, the thing is, when you do this Dehn twisting, you sort of can tell sort of what effect that is having on the short collection of curves while you're doing it. It has some controllable effect on it, and therefore you can control its effect on the projections and this distance, and you can get your hands on it. It's a little grungy.